And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is zoologist and science communicator, Ioana Bagnewska. And I am so excited to have you on the show today because in reading your bio, it is lengthy, it is interesting, you are wildly fascinating, everything that you have done and accomplished, and some of the very unique things that have been part of your life. So welcome to the show. I'm super happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Claire. It is an absolute pleasure.
Well, it seems like you have this insatiable curiosity going on. So can you tell me if this was something that you were born with as a child? Were you always this curious? Or is this something that you learned along the way?
I think I was always a bit of a nerd, and I wear this as a badge of honor. So I think nerds are fabulous people who are really interested in a particular topic. And for me, it started when I was maybe 5, when I started to learn how to read, and I had this book about animals, and I would just read it over and over and over again, and I was fascinated by anything to do with animals, and it got really, really quite nerdy. And this obsession with animals was something that kind of kept me going throughout most of my childhood. And then in high school, I wasn't sure what I wanted to study because I was interested in pretty much everything. I studied things like history and visual arts and biology and all things that I found useful in their own way. But this love of animals was something that always had an undercurrent in anything that I had done. And so in the end, I decided to go to uni and study biology. Which turned out to be very different from what I expected, because I spent a lot of time in the labs, which I didn't enjoy quite as much. So at the earliest opportunity to go into the field and do some ecology, I did that. I spent some time in Australia where I was looking at road ecology, so how roads influence wombats and wallabies. And spoiler alert, it's not great news for wombats and wallabies when they meet a road. And then I spent some time in the US at Rice University, where I did my semester abroad, and I had a lot of experience with the Houston Zoo, which is wonderful, and then went on to do my master's and doctorate in the UK, in Oxford. And there it was full on zoology rather than laboratory based biology, and it was much more enjoyable for me. So all of it was, yes, it was driven by curiosity, but it was particularly the curiosity about animals that really had me hooked.
Sure. So you embark on this path of zoology and you take it into areas that one might not normally think of. So you talked about roads and how those affect a wombat or other creatures. And you also look at things like bees in a very unique way. Can you share with me some of those interesting things that you did with bees?
Yes, of course. So the first project I was involved in after my PhD was working for a startup company where we used bees to detect explosives and other illegal substances, such as drugs. And we used bees' very, very basic instincts and the fact that they don't have an extremely sophisticated brain like other sniffer animals that we use. So most of the time when people think about drug detection animals, they think of dogs. And dogs are very complex animals. Anyone who owns a dog will confirm that. They sometimes overthink things, or sometimes they will look at what their handler is doing and make inferences from that rather than just focusing on the scent of something. Bees don't do that. Bees focus on a particular smell that they have been trained to smell. And they have an incredible sense of smell. It is actually much more sensitive than that of dogs. And because they're not as complex as dogs, they're not as easily distracted. So we relied on training bees for particular scents, and the association they made was, when they were given a particular scent, they were also fed sugar. So after just a few trials, they will learn that when they smell, let's say Semtex or some other illegal substance, cocaine, whatever it is that you train them for, they will stick out their tongue expecting something sweet. And so very quickly, you have this cohort, this little army of bees, who will stick out their tongues when they smell cocaine. And you'd think, well, a bee's tongue is pretty small, so how are you going to figure out when it is that they're sticking it out or not? So bees were sitting in these little cells with an infrared beam going underneath their faces, and when they stuck their tongues out, the beam would be broken, and so a reaction would register automatically. And they would be in service for just a couple of days, and then they would go off and retire into their retirement hive. So this was a very simple and a neat way of doing things, which I think is pretty fun. I like the whole aspect of looking at how people and nature interact for, well, for better or for worse, because road ecology, of course, that's people interacting with wildlife, but not in a good way for the wildlife. This was a project that did the opposite.
Yeah, it's interesting though. How do you even derive that thought process of, I bet we could train bees to do this? How does one come to that conclusion?
So I can't take credit for the initiation of that idea because I came to the project a bit later. But it's quite well known that bees have a good sense of smell, and bees can be trained to make simple choices. So there are lots of experiments with honeybees, but also with bumblebees to check if they can collaborate on pushing Lego blocks from one side to the other, or choosing particular colors if you train them to. So it's just getting that idea and building the infrastructure around it to enable a particular smell to kind of come to the bees. Because we were thinking, well, if this method were to be deployed in airports, obviously you can't have swarms of bees flying around. People don't take well to swarms of bees, believe it or not, in crowded spaces especially. So it was, and of course, another issue with using bees in places where there are lots of humans is false positives. So bees love fruits and they love flowers. This is what they live on. So anytime you have a person who has floral perfume or who's eating an apple or has any sort of sweet smell around them, you'd have our bees sticking out their tongues, not because that person is also carrying cocaine, but because they just smell like something that a bee really, really wants. So we would deploy the bees only on things like cargo, where you don't expect any sort of sweet smell. If you're transporting, say, I don't know, printers or chairs or something else that's quite boring and not very sweet, you would extract a sample of the smell from that cargo and present it to the bees, and then see what they do. So it's creating that infrastructure around it, and it's also thinking about, well, what are the methods currently available, and what are the pitfalls of the current of those very methods? So if you were using dogs for detecting drugs, you wouldn't be able to check a transport of, sausage meat with dogs, because they would go crazy because they like sausages. So obviously you have different methods for that. So it's a matter of pinpointing what methods would work with what sort of use cases.
Yeah, and you delve a lot into different creatures on our planet that might be out of the ordinary. You put together a book called The Modern Bestiary, a curated collection of wondrous creatures, and it takes us through 100 real fascinating animals. And it's in the style of a medieval bestiary, which is interesting because that wasn't always based. In fact, it was fact plus folklore. But you turned this type of reporting into a very scientific, accurate system. So tell me about this book and how you came to create it and how you decided on these 100 creatures.
Yes, so it was a lot of fun to write that book, I must say. It was a learning experience for me as well. So let's start with the whole idea of the bestiary and how to make it modern. So as you mentioned, the medieval bestiaries, they didn't focus as much on the biology, but more on the moral lessons that you could learn from animals. And if the morals didn't quite agree with the biology, then biology took a secondary place to the morals you had to infer. So that led to a lot of inaccuracies. You know, a lot of the bestiaries would include made up creatures like unicorns or mandrakes or mermaids or all of the above, just because they were useful for proving some sort of a moral point. And also you would have sometimes myths that persist to this day. For instance, many people believe that hedgehogs collect apples on their spikes. They don't, but it's such an image that can be seen in so many places. Even I've recently seen a Swarovski hedgehog with a little apple on its back, and you're like, no, this is something that goes back 2,000 years, I think. It goes back to Pliny the Elder. And hedgehogs don't collect fruit on their back. They don't eat fruit. They snuffle around orchards for grubs that are interested in rotting fruit. That's why you can sometimes see them there. But because of that, I thought, well, it's time to put things right. And I am in no position to moralize. I'm not a philosopher or a theologian. I am a biologist. And so I would like to use the idea of a bestiary to tell stories about nature. So each of the stories is a pretext to talk about evolution or ecology or conservation biology or behavior or all sorts of things, but it's actually grounded in science. And because there are so many stories, so each chapter is very short, I had some difficulty in which species to choose and which not to choose, because I think for a lot of biologists, we tend to lock ourselves up in a particular specialization. And apart from my bee stint, I have usually mainly worked with mammals, and I considered myself an expert in mammals. And all of a sudden I thought, well, we can't just do mammals, because in the grand scheme of things, there will be people who are interested in all sorts of other creatures. And if I'm doing an overview of animals, I can't just focus on one small group. And it was such a great learning experience. And I thought, well, if I had written this book as an undergrad, I probably wouldn't have become a mammal biologist, because other groups seem so much more interesting. So mammals are very conservative, if you think about them. So they only have two sexes, and they can't have that many offspring, and they don't do any wild things. They have a pretty stable body temperature, and they're cute and they're relatable, but it's not like they can do some crazy things, like, you know, they don't change sex halfway through their life, or they don't eat their mother's skin just to get nutrition, and the mother is happy to provide more skin, or they don't develop from pores on their parents' back, or they don't parasitize other animals and completely brainwash them in the process like some insects do. And you think, actually, many other taxonomic groups are much, much, much more exciting, but because they're much less sexy than mammals, you know, they're not the tigers or the chimpanzees or the dolphins, they don't get much attention. So I'm trying to bring these animals to the foreground as well. If you're looking for your favorite animal in this collection, you probably won't find it, because a lot of the animals you wouldn't have heard of in the first place.
Right. What do you think was the most interesting creature that provided something that even with your background was surprising to you?
Oof, it's hard to pick one story. There are lessons you can learn from everything. Maybe this is not really a learning experience per se, but it's a good analogy to life in academia. And it sounds a bit horrible, but bear with me. So there is a creature called the tongue-eating louse, and it does exactly what it says on the tin. It's a louse that eats the tongues of fish. So what happens is there's a small louse that crawls inside the fish. It gets in through the gills, and at first it's quite small, and then it grows. As it grows, it changes sex, because why not? When it starts off as a male, and then when it becomes bigger, it becomes a female. It moves into the mouth of a fish, and then it chews off the tongue, it eats the tongue, and it latches onto the fish's mouth, and it lives off the blood and nutrients that the fish provides. And you'd think, oh my goodness, this sounds horrible. But actually, the fish that have a louse for a tongue are doing fairly well. So they actually use that louse as a makeshift tongue. So fish tongues are not quite the same as ours. They're not muscular, they're more rigid and bony. They're just there to kind of keep the food in place rather than to use it in the same way that we do. And so sometimes in an academic setting, you think, this is not ideal what I'm finding myself in, but maybe it's not too bad. There are lots of great things about academia, but there are also lots of not so great things. And sometimes I think, well, if we have a louse for a tongue, that's how we sit around in a job where not everything is ideal, but we make do. So if you find yourself in a job situation where you think you're a bit like that fish with a louse for a tongue, remember that you can always change it. Unlike that fish, which is stuck with a louse now, you can go and do other things if this is what you prefer. So that's a more metaphorical lesson, but I think it's a terrifying and cool one at the same time.
Yes. Well, it's such an interesting book. I just think it's so wonderfully executed, and it really brings these creatures to life in a way that helps us understand the world better.
I think also one thing that I have learned when I was writing this book is that you should never trust people who make the arguments that something is not natural, and they bring up some sort of a species to prove their point, because absolutely any point can be proven if you pick the right creature to illustrate it. So you can say, oh, you know, people are not supposed to be vegetarian, or they are supposed to be vegetarian, or they're not supposed to be monogamous, or they are supposed to be monogamous because so and so and so is or isn't, or you've got, you know, these types of teeth, or these types of testicles, or these types of whatever it is. You can prove anything you want, because the animal kingdom is so diverse. So I would say be very, very cautious with using any sort of comparisons when it comes to humans.
Yeah, that's good advice, Ioana. You seem to have a real gift for trying to bring us all along into this greater understanding of some of these creatures and the wild things that our planet has to offer. Why is it important for you to dispel this information?
On a personal level, I just think it's fun to talk about animals and to talk about the cool things that maybe people have not heard about before. I have learned recently that the French word for science communicator is vulgarisateur, which means essentially science vulgarizer. And I often feel like I am the science vulgarizer, because as a zoologist, you mainly talk about sex and poo, because that's what animals do. And believe it or not, people love anecdotes about sex and poo. Especially kids, they like you talk to kids about poo and they are over the moon. They can spend hours talking about different types of poo. And so it's very easy because of that to engage people in different stories about wildlife. And I feel that if people know more about wildlife, they become more connected with it, they become more interested in it, and they might want to actually go out and experience some of it and see some of it. And when people do become more interested and connected, they will hopefully want to protect and conserve some of the wildlife as well. And so this is the ultimate mission that I have. So going from the silly conversations about, sea cucumbers breathing with their butts, to conservation of different habitats. That's what I'm after.
Well, you do it beautifully. You weave these stories of animals into our lives that I do think make people curious like you and make people want to understand what is around us. And I wholly agree. We here at This Green Earth talk about if you have a greater understanding and education of something, the more you want to preserve and protect it. So we appreciate what you do. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth. And if people want to learn more about you and your writing, is there a website they can go to?
They can look up my first name and my last name. I can spell it out for
Sure.
you. It's JoannaBaggniewska.com. Or if you have a description of this episode, just copy paste it.
There you go.
Being Polish means you're always having to spell out your name to everyone in the English speaking world, at least. Do look
Right.
me up. Or do you look up the modern bestiary?
Well, it's zoologist and author and science communicator Joanna Bagnewska, and the book is called Modern Bestiary, a curated collection of wondrous creatures. And also, Joanna, you are fascinating. You've done a TED Talk. There's a lot to see about you. So when we put this up on our website, I encourage you to go and copy and paste that name and Google Joanna, because it is a world of fascinating information that you are putting out there. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Clay.